Welcome to EncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. EncLive On Air is a podcast from EncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, EncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Eli Lilly, we had the pleasure of speaking with Catherine Callaghan Coombs, MD, an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Hematology at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, to preview exciting abstracts that will be presented at the upcoming 2021 ASH Annual Meeting and Exposition starting this Saturday. In our exclusive interview, Coombs discussed research that will be presented at the upcoming 2021 ASH Annual Meeting and Exposition in B-cell malignancies, including that with covalent and non-covalent BTK inhibitors, COVID-19 vaccinations, and time-limited combinations. Thank you so much, Dr. Coombs, for joining us on an episode of EncLive On Air to discuss exciting upcoming ASH abstracts. Happy to have you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So starting off, an extensive number of abstracts will be presented at this year's meeting. I know the meeting is a hybrid format. I unfortunately won't be able to attend in person. I'm not sure about yourself, but I'm looking forward to getting back to live coverage.
I am excited. I will be there in person, which was a kind of last minute decision, but evaluating the current rates of COVID, I think it's safe as can be, and I'm very excited to reunite with some colleagues.
Definitely. So diving right into it, what are you looking forward to hearing the results of at this year's ASH meeting?
There's really a lot of presentations that I'm excited about. My primary clinical focus is CLL, so I do some other leukemias, but I would say I'm mainly going to focus on CLL abstracts, of which there are really several that I'm excited to hear from.
Starting off sort of going through these abstracts, what are you looking forward to?
I would categorize them in a few broad categories. So the first is that we're going to see a number of results from the Sequoia trial, which is zanubrutinib. So abstract 67 is looking at the combination of zanubrutinib with venetoclax in patients with treatment naive CLL and SLL with deletion 17p. The abstract alludes to it is a pretty short follow-up, just 9.7 months. However, it's a combination I'm excited to kind of see more information on, given my overall favorable opinion of zanubrutinib based on some other studies. It does appear to be a very well-tolerated newer BTK inhibitor. And then, of course, the combination of BTK and venetoclax is always likely to lead to great clinical responses. The abstract only discusses 35 of the 80 planned patients enrolled, but they had 31 who had reached their initial efficacy assessment at 3 months following the Zanu start, and there was a really high overall response rate of 96.8%. And so they're planning on presenting updated safety efficacy data, so I'm eager to see what that shows. The next abstract of this Sequoia trial is the randomized portion of zanubrutinib versus BR. So, you know, I don't think any of us were surprised to hear that this was a positive trial. BR is kind of a bit of an outdated comparator arm. So, you know, I am excited to kind of see how Zanu performs in general. Again, I knew it would beat BR. I think most of us wouldn't have bet on the other arm. So the primary endpoint on that study was IRC assessed PFS. They randomized 479 patients, again, excluding del17p, which is, you know, good because we wouldn't want those patients to get BR. And it showed up prolonged PFS with Zanu with a hazard ratio of 0.42, which appeared to be observed across all subgroups except for mutated IGHV patients. They also report 24-month PFS for Zanu of 85.5% compared to BR of 69.5%. And, you know, I think the other thing that's really nice about this abstract is that we get more detail into the toxicity of Zanu in the frontline population, and we see really low rates of atrial fibrillation. And so specifically, the Zanu-treated patients from this large study were 3.3% compared to actually 2.6% of patients in the BR arm had AFib. So looks like a good safety signal, certainly excellent efficacy. And so that's another thing that I'm very excited to see the full presentation.
So we're not only seeing data with covalent BTK inhibitors at the meeting, but also that of non-covalent inhibitors. What would you like to highlight there?
There are a couple different abstracts regarding these non-covalent inhibitors. So the first one is LOXO 305, now called pirtobrutinib. So there are abstracts for both the CLL and the mantle cell lymphoma patients. The abstracts themselves don't give updated data, but they do allude to that newer data regarding efficacy on more patients will be presented at the meeting. So I'll eagerly be awaiting these presentations to see how that drug is performing in both those patient groups on the day that it's presented. The other abstract is the other ongoing development of a non-covalent inhibitor, the one that was formerly called RQL-531. It's now called MK-1026. So we see another presentation in that same session as the pirtobrutinib presentation for CLL to look at the preliminary efficacy and safety of this other non-covalent inhibitor. So it appears to have good response rates. They report an overall response rate of 58% for the CLL, SLL patients that were treated at the preliminary recommended phase 2 dose. I think one thing that may be a bit different about this compound compared to pirtobrutinib is that it does seem like there may be a bit in the way of toxicity in that they report grade 3 or higher treatment emergent AEs in 68% of participants. There were 7 grade 5 treatment emergent AEs, including deaths from disease progression and 3, and then, you know, a number of other things, including sepsis and respiratory failure. So I think at least from the early data for pirtobrutinib, that drug really seems to shine in the way of not only efficacy, but also very, very few high grade toxicities. But I think it'll be great to see both of those presented side by side. And obviously, we can be the judge of which drug looks the most promising when we see the full data sets.
We can't go without talking about COVID vaccines in the current climate. So what are we seeing there?
Definitely. So, you know, a huge concern for my patients with CLL is COVID. And now, of course, is the vaccine going to work or not? So we know from prior vaccination studies that CLL patients have lower responses to vaccines. And so we see a couple different abstracts looking at vaccine responses to patients with CLL. So abstract 637 reviews vaccination responses in a CLL cohort, and they saw that double dose mRNA vaccination generated a humoral response in 52% of that CLL cohort. However, a third dose, so the booster, induced seroconversion in 42% of the patients who remained seronegative after the second dose. So I do think this kind of supports our current practice to recommend boosters in our CLL patients. Obviously, the boosters are likely helpful whether one has CLL or not, but it's something that I feel very strongly about recommending to my CLL patients. They do also mention that the major independent predictor of not having an antibody response was an ongoing treatment with a BTK inhibitor. And so treatment with BTK does seem to dampen the immune response. Unfortunately, it's probably unavoidable for many patients who, you know, do need that ongoing therapy to control their disease. The other abstract is 638. So the next one in the series, that one actually is interesting. So most of the time when we look at vaccine response, we're looking at the antibody level. So they actually are looking at the cellular immune response. So how do the T cells respond? And so they found in that abstract that the cellular immune response was blunted in most CLL patients. And they found a correlation between T cell response and serologic response to the vaccine. So overall, you know, interesting data supports boosters, but still certainly not the responses that we would like to see to protect our patients from COVID. And I'll be excited to see more details from those presentations.
And I know you specialize in CLL, but there's going to be some interesting CML data at the meeting as well. What would you say that is?
The one that's gotten the most pre-meeting press so far was abstract 631, at least from what I've seen on, you know, Twitter, which, you know, isn't necessarily the definitive source. But, you know, I think it's actually pretty interesting. This is an abstract, I think, from MD Anderson, where they analyzed patients with newly diagnosed chronic phase CML, and apparently they do low-dose dasatinib frequently enough that they could do this analysis of low-dose dasatinib, specifically 50 milligrams a day, versus standard dose dasatinib of 100 milligrams a day. And then they did propensity score matching to identify patients in each cohort to kind of match the baseline differences. And so what they did then is compare the rates of response and toxicity among patients getting that low dose of dasatinib with kind of the standard dose. And if anything, they saw probably better outcomes for the patients with the low dose. And so specifically, they saw lower rates of the, you know, kind of worrisome side effect pleural effusion of 6% in the low dose cohort versus 21% in the standard dose cohort. And this overall doesn't seem to compromise efficacy. And if anything, I think the low dose may at least have a favorable effect on efficacy based on the numbers they saw, maybe due to patients being better able to adhere to the therapy by having fewer significant side effects prompting dose holds. And, you know, it's not a randomized trial. So I wouldn't necessarily call it practice changing, but I think it's very provocative and something that, you know, maybe worth looking into further.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a packed meeting this year, as always. Is there anything else that you wanted to emphasize?
There are really a lot of presentations looking at the combination of ibrutinib plus venetoclax. So some are follow-ups to trials that we've already seen some preliminary results of, such as the CAPTIVATE study, the GLOW study. Another one that I'll be interested to hear the results of the presentation is actually this PHILO phase 2 trial. This trial compared untreated fit patients with intermediate risk CLL with either ibrutinib plus venetoclax or FCR. The limitation of this study, at least currently, is that the median follow-up is really short, but it actually was a bit surprising to me. Their conclusions were that at least these preliminary results showed a lower bone marrow MRD rate in the ibrutinib with venetoclax arm compared to the FCR arm, but that was only at month 9. And so, you know, I think we do need more follow-up to see how the I plus V arm stacks up against FCR, you know, with longer follow-up, because a lot of these patients are continuing on therapy. The last study that I also am excited to hear about is the CLL13 trial will be presenting its data. So CLL13 was a really huge trial of, I think, almost 1,000 patients. It had four different therapies. So one was a chemoimmunotherapy arm that was either FCR or BR based on the patient's age. And then the other arms were a variety of venetoclax time-limited regimens. So they all were 12 cycles of Ven, but Ven was either in combination with rituximab, obinutuzumab, or obinutuzumab and venetoclax. So 200 some patients on each arm. And the thing that contrasts this with CLL14 is that this was kind of a young fit population, a median age of 61. So CLL14, of course, the comparator arm was chlorambucil and obinutuzumab, and those patients were, you know, mostly kind of unfit and older. And so here is how does venetoclax perform in kind of the fit group. And so their primary endpoint, the one that they discuss, is undetectable MRD in peripheral blood at month 15. And so this was significantly higher in the obinutuzumab venetoclax arm compared to chemoimmunotherapy, specifically 86.5% of the patients that got OB and Ven had undetectable MRD in the marrow versus 52% in that chemoimmunotherapy arm. They also saw that there was a superior rate of undetectable MRD in the OB ibrutinib Ven arm compared to chemo, but not with the rituximab Ven arm, which had an undetectable MRD rate of 57%. I wouldn't say that reflects negatively upon the combination of rituximab and venetoclax, which, you know, we've seen great success with in the relapse setting. The big difference there is that in relapse CLL per the Murano trial, we do 2 years of venetoclax. So I would not extrapolate this to that. But overall, it just shows the superiority of Ven-containing regimens, especially with obinutuzumab in this specific scenario, which is fit frontline patients.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Eli Lilly. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OnkLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OnkLive and OnkLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OnkLive and OnkLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OnkLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OnkLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OnkLive On Air.